plant life inspires folklore and tradition, as well as science and our industrial world. And it has inspired today's guest, Guido Mazet, to make a lifelong study of plants, science, and mysticism. He weaves these aspects of life into his Inner Traditions published book, The Wild Medicine Solution, Healing with Aromatic, Bitter, and Tonic Plants. Guido is an herbalist and educator in every sense of the word, enabling his web of life experience to intersect with yours, I promise. I'm Robin Clare. Stay tuned. This is Tributaries. Guido, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Robin. It's great to be here.
I was glad to read almost right off the bat that you acknowledge we will never know all the details of human physiology or all of any extenuating circumstances. And this, of course, includes plant biology and physiology. As an herbalist, I would imagine this could ultimately be very freeing, but perhaps initially be binding. And I was wondering what your experience was with that.
Yeah, I think that's a really a good observation, and it's something that kind of is inherent in any scientific understanding of really any discipline, from exploring the cosmos to the depths of the ocean to the depths of the way the human body works or how an ecology interfaces with that. And I think that that's okay, right? The mystery drives the discovery process, and without mystery, we wouldn't have any good questions to ask, and science would be at a standstill. But what has been, like you say, at first frustrating to me was, well, am I going to be safe? Is it okay? What am I missing here? And the sort of fear of unknowing can sometimes paralyze people. But what I realized in studying herbal medicine and in practicing herbal medicine is that there's kind of a secondary, or not secondary, but different way of knowing that herbal medicine has employed forever. And that is sort of a whole picture knowledge system, which often uses mythology or analogy or poetry to give us a gestalt, or like a whole picture understanding of how a growing botanical species might interface with a living, breathing human being. And you can't ever, it's like looking at a landscape, you know, you can't necessarily see the detail of every stone or leaf in that landscape, but you can still take it in as a whole, and you can understand that it is a moist landscape, or that it's a landscape that is rich in conifers, or that it's going to be a much more dry landscape. And that has a feeling for you and an emotional impact for you. And I think people have encoded these feelings and these emotions in story and in myth. And you can actually use that, you know, discussion of chi and discussion of body humors. It's not really just a quaint artifact of human history. It actually is a powerful way to describe how plants work as a whole in the context of human living system. So where science, you know, will always have unfathomable depths, human beings have an ability to, through art, I think, perceive things in a sort of transcendent fashion, get everything all at once. Even though you can't describe all of the detail, you still get this whole, which can be very powerful and very useful. And so being able to add that into herbal medicine, I think, makes you a better practitioner as an herbalist. And it's one of the things I love about herbal medicine is that it lets you have that. It's okay. It's encouraged to use these old energetic and mythologic models for understanding how plants work.
Yes, I love the picture you just drew for us in that. For me, I went to this place where you said, you know, there's always somewhere to go with science, and our depth just is so endless that it will always give room for the discovery in science and art, as you just brought in. And it's like we have been given an endless and timeless playroom.
And thank goodness for that.
Yes,
right?
Absolutely. As you share in your book, you have looked at system theories devised for physics and biology. And I was wondering if you could just share a little bit about what part of that do you draw from most in your work with herbs?
I think the reason I bring in system theory, and actually this is why I love herbal medicine so much, is it allows this thread in my life, which is the thread that is really fascinated with biochemistry, to be able to merge with this other thread in my life, which is really into, you know, mythology and mysticism and spiritualism. Herbal medicine, you get to use them both, as I was just saying, and I really love it for that, and it kind of saved me from this sort of mental meltdown that was going to happen and me trying to reconcile these two apparently divergent streams. But they're not really divergent, right? And so what I was actually studying systems theory before I really came to understand that herbal medicine has been using systems theory for thousands of years. It just doesn't call it that necessarily. So in essence, or in brief, the way the system theorist approaches reality is they attempt to look at it as a network or a pattern or a system, rather than trying to look at the individual components of it. So again, to go back to the landscape idea, you know, it's taking a look at an ecological landscape and how clouds contribute to water in the streams, and the streams contribute to water in the lake, and then the lake evaporates, and like the water cycle is a system, and not as much the reduction of the system into its component parts. And that's really, you know, when an herbalist approaches someone who might have a health imbalance and a plant or plants that might be useful to them, they look at it as a system that works in many different levels. And so you can start with a system with a really super simple relationship. It's this network of components relating to each other, and it can be incredibly simple. So, for example, you know, when we're talking about the system of planet Earth, we can start very simply saying that, you know, planet Earth has night and it has day, and that's it. And you can make really good decisions and inform your action based on that very simple understanding of the system, that day goes into night and night goes into day, and the cycle keeps repeating itself. So, for example, if you're trying to use your eyes, you might choose to go out during the day. You can make decisions based on that. Then you can take the day and you can break it out, you know, into like morning versus afternoon, and there's just different qualities to the light in those different times and different things that are happening during those times, during that pattern of flow and change. And my point ultimately is that when you approach things as systems, you see a couple of things going on. One is that the system is self-similar, meaning, you know, day and night are changes that are replicated, like even during the day, there's like a brightest part and a least bright part of the day. And during the, you know, brightest noon part, there's a time that is sort of hottest there and a little bit less hot there. And you can just keep going down, 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 and it all has a sort of replicating self-similar quality to it. This is useful because if you know that a plant, for example, acts on a certain piece of the system, and you can stay very simple, like night and day, you can say, is this plant hot and spicy like ginger, or is it cooling and you know, relaxing like maybe peppermint or something like that? And you make that distinction and you say, okay, well, ginger can work then on someone who feels really cold, and peppermint might work on someone who's really hot and has a fever. But then you can take it down in further and you're like, well, what about, you know, the person is relatively balanced, but what about heat in this particular tissue? Can we see a relative balance overall in the system, but a little bit of heat in the joints, for instance? Anyway, so the self-similarity makes it so that you don't necessarily have to get all the way down into the finest, smallest detail. You can stay higher up, and you know that if you work on the system based on your understanding at the higher level, you're probably going to affect similar systems further down in similar ways. Additionally, another thing that's useful in systems theory is that you can stay ridiculously simple, because there are, what chaos theorists and systems theorists have found is that there's these aggregators or these nodes in the system, in the network, that are sort of important places of functional change, meaning when something goes wrong there, you tend to see ripples and repercussions in many other places. So the examples that I use in the book, for instance, are like digestion and liver health. If your liver is off, you tend to see issues throughout the body in many other areas, ranging from increased hypersensitivity and allergies to maybe problems with bowel function regulation. So systems theory tells us, yeah, you might not know all the details of everything, but if you can pick out the places that are most connected, that have the greatest amount of relationships, that are hubs in the network, so to speak, then and work on those, then you don't necessarily need to know about everything else. you adjust the key hyperconnected hub, and you can, through its links, positively impact a whole lot of different places. This is kind of like, you know, we see the World Wide Web organized in this way, and systems theorists love the web because it actually is, believe it or not, replicating an ecology better than any computer simulation we've come up with, because it kind of is growing organically. There's these hubs like search engines that if you can, you know, affect them or impact them, you can have massive effects across the web. So I think, you know, without necessarily getting down to knowing absolutely everything, you can still make very effective choices as to how to intervene therapeutically in a human being. If you approach that human being from a systems perspective, and you work at a top-level network by looking at the things that are most interconnected.
Yes, I have a funny story. It was funny to me anyway. I was on a plane reading your book, The Wild Medicine Solution, Healing with Aromatic, Bitter, and Tonic Plants. And I was taking notes, and then I glanced over to the woman next to me, and she was reading a book on business models. And I saw the highlighted number 2 model was enable random collision of unusual suspects. And my daughter is starting, she's involved with a startup business, and I wrote it down because I wanted her to, you know, obviously keep a broad perspective. So I wanted to share that with her. And then when I was looking over my notes to do the interview today, I just thought, well, where does that come from? I don't remember reading that in Guido's book. And then I remembered what happened on the airplane, and I was just cracking up because I thought, enable random collision of unusual suspects. This is nature in a nutshell.
And that is exactly what happened to you when you were sitting there.
Right.
which is really interesting. And what would be cool is probably to see that there are some connections between some of those business models and some of the systems that I talk about in the book.
Of course, yes.
And, you know, that's because we're all coming from the same place, right? We're all outgrowths of nature, and nature is working through us, and there's a reason these things are self-similar.
Yes, of course.
Yeah.
Once someone is well-versed in the use of herbs, then their line of thinking becomes very common sense or intuitive, which leaves the systems theory kind of in the dust. Can you give an example of that, maybe a preparation for a certain herb or food or an action for change of season?
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, you know, right now we've been talking a lot about springtime stuff. Because, you know, here in Vermont, at least, things are just starting to get springy. It's, you know, the end of April, and we're getting blooms on the trees, and the dandelions are trying to put out their first few flowers. And, you know, I talk about systems theory, and that's great, but like you say, it is more a way of, like, trying to wrap our rational mind around what human beings and animals have been doing intuitively and comfortably for thousands and thousands of years. So the spring renewal idea, I think, is a good example. Animals, you know, one of my favorite stories is the story of the hibernating bear in the Rockies, actually, coming out of hibernation. And one of the first things that bears often do if they have access to this plant is they'll go and dig up some of the OSHA root that is found usually at elevation in the American West and Southwest. And they'll, like, eat it and spread it all over their bodies and just kind of revel in coating themselves with this stuff. And it's, you know, there's scientific, quote-unquote, reasons for this. It's an antiseptic substance, and it's antiparasitic, so maybe they're helping to get rid of some bugs that have been growing and feeding on their coats over the course of hibernation. And it also is a strong digestive enhancer, right? So it might help them kind of get their belly going again after not eating for a long time and stimulate their appetite and get them out to forage. But really, you know, you look at this bear, and it's like you are just communing and having fun. You're rolling around with this plant, having a blast, and you're not thinking about any of this stuff. And so herbalists, and I would say just humans, from a general perspective, have been kind of doing similar rituals every spring. And I think the dandelion is a great plant that has been part of that ritual a lot of the times, and people will go and they'll harvest dandelion greens. This is something my Aunt Rita and my dad and I in Italy would do a lot as I was growing up. You go out with a sharp knife and you just cut the dandelion crowns before they start making flowers. You come back and you dress them in olive oil and vinegar and a little bit of salt, and you just eat them as a crunchy salad. And it's bitter, you know, as I won't kid around. As a child, I wasn't necessarily super fond of it, but I did develop a taste for it, and it's not bad. And what this does is it you know, it gets our digestive juices going. It improves our liver function. It might help break up some of the digestive and liver stagnation that has been building up over eating weird foods over the course of the winter that aren't necessarily as fresh or as local. And obviously that makes us feel better. But then there's also this great idea, which herbalists usually go to, and this is how it, you know, probably still presented this way, and it probably was presented this way for thousands of years before we had a scientific understanding. Herbalists go to these plants in the spring because they're a way to renew our body. And we talk about going out and looking for bitter greens because we want to wake up and challenge our system, just like the bear is waking up and challenging his system. And we want to do it with plants that have this particularly bitter flavor because it's a way to, sometimes even sour flavor, bitter and sour, it's a way to mimic the flavors that they're seeing, that people are seeing in the growing green plants and the new shoots and the new barks that are coming up from trees and tree buds to green plants in the field. And it really is down to like that same basic urge that, you know, your dog has when they see the first snow melt away and reveal grass, and they go out and they munch on that grass. It's a reason to commune and renew through communion. Now, I think, unfortunately, over the years, this has gotten a little bit changed or diluted or altered, where now we start talking about cleaning or cleansing the human being in spring. And I don't think that's the traditional way of looking at it. It's much more of a joyous, like, woohoo, it's green out there. Let's get this stuff into our bodies in a real communion kind of revelry, as opposed to we are dirty and we need to clean ourselves out.
I know. So I agree with you so much. There's so much healing, you know. It's like, well, there's a part of me that wants to totally get away from that. Let's just sort of assume here we're well instead of everything is getting healed all the time. Everything is in flux, and we're moving through whatever we're moving through. And of course, if someone has a horrible disease, you want to heal it. But that mindset is, I'm just so happy you brought that up. That's really lovely the way you said that. Thank you.
Oh, yeah. Listen, I mean, I think at its heart, real herbal medicine is generally positivist. And it says, like, human beings are awesome and juicy and crazy and generally really damn good at dealing with almost anything that is thrown our way. When we get imbalances, it's probably because we're not outside enough. It's probably because we're not doing that communion with plants enough. And, you know, aside from the really bad diseases that you mentioned. But I want to get away from this idea of modern malaise being caused by bad things that we need to be afraid of.
Right.
And I want to get more into the idea of modern malaise is just, you know, a lack of partying down with nature. I mean, many people talk about this stuff. Rich Louv is one of my favorite authors, and he talks about nature deficit disorder in kids rather than this attention deficit disorder. And his idea, rather than, you know, freaking out about toxins that may be causing this in kids, is to say, like, they don't get to walk in parks anymore. Go outside. Play outside.
I know. It was so sad. My granddaughter, when she first started in first grade, she's not the kind of child that really acted out, but she just needed to go outside, and she would say things, and then the remedy was the teacher made her stay in during lunch, and it was just, you know, brought tears to my eyes, but that's a whole other story. In mentioning how difficult it is to quantify the efficacy of healing with herbs, I wonder if the combined use, we are getting into the three portions of the plants that you mention in your title of your book, aromatic, bitter, and tonic. I wonder if the combined use of those three is greater than the sum of its parts. I can only imagine it must be, but moving into that now, how do you talk about that?
I think what you're asking is a little bit about synergy, if I understand
yes.
you correctly. And there's, I think it's a really rich question, and there's two parts, I guess. First of all, a plant in and of itself is a synergy, right? It doesn't just have one chemical in it, and that makes it very different from a drug over the counter or prescription or whatnot, or even to a certain extent a supplement that might be, you know, a vitamin C supplement or something like that. So plants themselves have these synergies, which make them, I think, more gentle potentially and applicable across a wider range of conditions. And the example I use in the book is yohimbe, right, and which is used as an aphrodisiac. And It certainly has some contraindications with it, particularly high blood pressure, and there's reasons for that. But the alkaloid, the isolated chemical, yohimbine, when taken out of the plant, is orders of magnitude more dangerous because it's missing the synergists that the plant has inside it that tend to buffer the negative effects of yohimbine alone. Other alkaloids like ajmaline that tend to slow down the heart and relax it, preventing some of the negative impacts on people with high blood pressure. So plants, first of all, are synergies in and of themselves. But then if you combine them with each other, you get a whole other set of synergies, and that's definitely true, you know. And it's not limited to just combining plants. It's combining plant and food. It's also combining things like massage and plants, or aromatherapy and plants, or exercise and food and plants. You get this sort of virtuous cycle, let's say, where the use of one augments the use of another and then reinforces the ongoing pattern in a person. Really, I believe, you know, herbal medicine is a way for people to plug back into nature, as we were just talking about. And when you do that, weird things happen to your brain and weird things happen to your spirit. Your outlook changes, and it makes it easier for you to be in nature and easier for you to understand the way these plants work in your body. And so that becomes, you become even more desirous of using them, and it becomes even easier to use them in your system. But to just get super specific, one example, for instance, when you talk about a bitter plant, like, for example, dandelion root that we were just mentioning, and you talk about a tonic plant like, let's say, reishi mushroom, which I mentioned in the book as well. Dandelion root works on the liver, works on digestion, and the general analogy is that if you think of digestion as a furnace, a bitter plant like dandelion makes it burn more cleanly so that you don't have as much creosote or smoke or smolder coming out through the exhaust. And for our bodies, what that means is that if the liver is processing things more effectively, you tend to have fewer potentially irritating chemicals coming out of the liver because it's kind of getting metabolizing everything cleanly with less byproducts. That's great. And in Europe, for example, they'll use dandelion root or gentian root, which is another very bitter root, for allergies because it decreases the amount of reactive chemicals that are present in your bloodstream. So now pollen and dander and stuff like that isn't quite as harmful. But we will also use reishi for allergies because it works on the immune system and on the immune function. And it kind of helps the immune system realize that it might not need just all by itself to overreact to a pollen or a piece of animal dander. And when you combine the two together, you need to use less of each one of them. So it's very often the case that we'll do like a bitter plus a medicinal mushroom like reishi for helping support people who experience seasonal allergies. One is working on liver function and digestive function. The other is working on balancing immune function, and they synergize really well together. And then you get a plant like chocolate, right, that has a bitter quality. It has a great aromatic quality. It has a little bit of that, you know, smell and aroma and volatile quality that helps with the mind and the spirit. And it has an amazing tonic quality. The flavonoid content is really, really well researched for impacting cardiovascular disease and potentially being useful in cancer as well, because it's a heart tonic and a blood vessel tonic. And so if you get a plant like chocolate, it's got all three. It's got the bitter digestive and liver activation. It's got a slight amount of aromatics that work on our nervous system, along with the alkaloids that work on our nervous system, and then it has a great tonic action. So you can combine them and get sort of a synergist effect, but you have to remember that plants in and of themselves are also great synergists.
Yes. It's funny. I was going to promise not to tell anyone that you have a burdock and seaweed appetizer recipe in your book because you mentioned chocolate as the first tonic. Just doesn't sound as appetizing, burdock
well,
and seaweed.
Well, I think you need both, right? And part of the idea with
sure.
burdock and seaweed is you may not always want to go for the sweet thing. There might be a point in actually giving something that doesn't taste super sweet, giving that to your tongue as well.
Of course. You write that herbs have the strengths, but just because it has been around for thousands of years, it doesn't make it inherently valid. And then you mention Aristolochia.
Yeah,
can you tell us the story of this plant and how it relates to that?
Yeah, so Aristolochia serpentina. It's a viney plant. There's certain kinds of Aristolochias that grow in this hemisphere too, but that particular one is a plant from China. And it has say, 2,500 to 3,000 year traditional use history for urinary complaints, particularly. And the root and the leaves and vine of the plant was used for things like urinary tract infections or urinary inflammation. It was also used for prostate inflammation or difficulty with the urine stream, pain in the bladder, kidney infections, stuff like that, where it was added to formulas in traditional Chinese medicine. It contains, we now know, and there are other plants like, for example, our local wild ginger, it contains aristolochic acid, which is a chemical that really we've only been able to isolate in the last 50 or 60 years. And it's only really been in the last 15 or 20 years that we've seen that in areas of China where this plant is endemic and it grows commonly, and so it's routinely prescribed, you see dramatically increased rates of bladder and urinary cancer. And people die from these tumors. And for a while, you know, it was like, well, who the heck knows? There's so many different factors. But they did pharmacological research on aristolochic acid, and they found that it was mutagenic and potentially could cause cancer in cells. And then they tried to control for as many other possible factors as they could. And at this point, the research is so conclusive on aristolochia that it's been banned from use, except for very limited periods of time, for very specific acute complaints. But people were taking this stuff for years at a time, you know, to deal with their urinary systems or deal with their prostates. And that's when we started to see increased rates of bladder and urinary system cancer. So, again, the examples of plants that actually turn out to be toxic or detrimental when they're subjected to the modern scientific scrutiny, they're extremely few and far between. Aristolochia is pretty much the only really consistent example. But we have other plants, like, for example, kava kava. If it's used in excess for long periods of time, it can have negative effects on the liver. We've characterized the effect of kava lactones on liver cells and found that they can potentially cause problems if you take tons of it, way in outside of the normal range of use. But the aristolochia story is one that I always, you know, keep in the back of my head as a caution. You know, just because something has been used forever doesn't necessarily mean it's safe. It also doesn't necessarily mean it's effective. But when we have an understanding of the chemistry and a long traditional use record, and we have no safety issues that show up in the literature, and no safety issues that show up in the traditional use record, then you can be pretty confident that this stuff is going to be okay. And it's, I think, a huge advantage in general of herbal medicine is that we have thousands of years of people putting this stuff into their bodies, and very, very, very rarely does ever anything come up. And, you know, I bring up aristolochia because it's kind of the exception that proves the rule, to be perfectly honest. You have to dig to find a plant like aristolochia. And really, it's one of the only ones that exist out there in the record where humans have been taking it for a long time and been oblivious to its negative health effects, and then modern science has rescued us from the health effects,
Oh, I feel so safe now.
there's definitely herbs that are out there that are not good for you, like, you know, belladonna. Atropa belladonna is highly toxic. But people knew that because when they gave atropa belladonna, people died. So there was sort of a immediate action going on there where people realized that there was some toxicity to this plant. And so we've known what the poisonous and toxic plants have been forever. And really the only ones that act more subtly that we might not catch, aristolochia is probably the only one out there, to be perfectly honest.
I love this conversation, and we'll conclude it next week with Guido Mazze, The Wild Medicine Solution, Healing with Aromatic, Bitter, and Tonic Plants, is his book. For any guest information, to listen to archives, share resources, and sign up for our weekly programming, it's tributariesradio.wordpress.com. For podcasting, it's iTunes Tributaries Radio. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.